Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. The National Native Media Conference wrapped up earlier this month. The focus of the event was empowering story, and many were inspired to keep making paths to make sure Native voices are heard. The staff of Native America Calling and National Native News were there. Today we're going to share a little bit of what we experienced. Stay tuned for interviews and discussions about journalism right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Nearly 2 weeks ago, a city worker in Riverton, Wyoming, was arrested for murder and attempted murder after two Native American men were shot inside an alcohol detoxification center. Northern Arapaho leaders are calling on the Department of Justice for the attack to be prosecuted as a federal hate crime. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank has more.
29-year-old Stallone Trosper died in the attack. 50-year-old James Goggles Jr. is hospitalized and recovering from his injuries. Both victims are enrolled members of the Northern Arapaho Tribe, one of two Indian nations sharing Wyoming's Wind River Reservation. According to an arrest affidavit, the suspect, Roy Clyde, confessed to the attack and told police he was targeting homeless people, regardless of race. Tribal officials and the victims' families don't buy that explanation. Trosper's uncle, George Abeda, says his nephew was not experiencing homelessness and wants to see Clyde charged with a hate crime.
We're still true to the cause in making sure that justice is served on behalf of my nephew, Stallone. So let the truth be told. If it's a duck, let's call it a duck. If that's a hate crime, it was a hate crime. If he was looking for a homeless person, I don't think he looked for large backpacks or shopping carts. He was not looking for the homeless. He was looking for Native.
On Wednesday, the Northern Arapaho Business Council met with the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice. Councilman Ronald Oldman says the talks were productive.
We traveled hundreds of miles to Washington to voice our concerns of our tribal members and our families. They listened to our experiences of racism and discussed the shootings with us. We're thankful that the senior officials in the Justice Department Civil Rights Division committed to taking a hard look at this senseless incident.
Wyoming does not have a separate law that gives harsher sentences for hate crimes, which is why the tribe went to the feds. Riverton police say they would welcome a federal hate crime investigation. I'm Aaron Schrank in Riverton.
A Lakota farmer is fighting for the right to plant a new crop of industrial hemp on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Alex Whiteplume began growing hemp in the late 1990s after the Oglala Sioux tribe legalized the crop for industrial use. But drug enforcement agents soon seized the crop. He spent several years fighting in federal court and is restricted to plant again, despite new provisions in the Farm Bill that opened the door for the crop. Charles Michael Ray reports.
Round one of this fight occurred over a decade ago. That's when Alex Whiteplume lost his bid to grow industrial hemp on Pine Ridge. But in round two, Whiteplume has a new ally in his corner, attorney Tim Purdon, who's filing a motion to lift the 11-year-old federal injunction.
You know, I have a lot of respect for the lawyers at the Department of Justice. As a former U.S. attorney, I love the department, but they're just wrong when it comes to the tribal sovereignty piece here.
Purdon was most recently U.S. attorney for North Dakota. He's now working pro bono on the side of Whiteplume. Like the Oglala Sioux tribe, North Dakota also legalized hemp, and years ago, Purdon fought for the right to see it grown there. Purdon says this case is in part about tribal sovereignty, but he adds it's also about Whiteplume's rights. Purdon says Congress legalized industrial hemp in the last Farm Bill, and he says the injunction that restricts Alex Whiteplume from even applying for a permit is unfair.
Here you have a resident of the Pine Ridge Reservation who wants to grow non-drug, non-psychotropic industrial hemp and perhaps start an industrial hemp industry in one of the poorest counties in America. And this injunction, in light of these current circumstances, just seems crazy to me.
Officials with the U.S. Attorney's Office in South Dakota say they have no comment. The Obama administration is holding back on enforcing marijuana laws in states or tribes that legalize hemp. That's a policy that could change with a new president after 2016. But Tim Purdon says the industrial hemp provision in the Farm Bill will stand regardless. I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Support by Humboldt State University's part-time online Master of Social Work. The 3.5-year program focuses on decolonizing work with rural and indigenous communities. Applications accepted August 1st to 31st for a January start at humboldt.edu/social work.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Earlier this month, the National Native Media Conference took place in the Washington, D.C. area, Crystal City, Virginia, to be specific. And the conference was co-hosted by the Native American Journalists Association, or NAJA, and the Native Public Media. And the Native America Calling crew was there alongside many other Native media professionals that share Native stories in all mediums, like print, broadcast, and online. And the theme of this year's conference was Empower Your Story. Today, we're going to share what Native media is doing to get more Native stories out there and why their voice matters when it comes to covering the news. And we'll also hear what issues are important, not only to Native communities, but also Native media professionals who are striving to get accurate coverage of our Native nations to the masses. And as you hear what we brought back to you and what Native journalists have to say about their profession, we also want you to join in the discussion. Tell us and other journalists tuning in today what issues are impacting your Native life today. And you can also follow this conversation with the hashtag #EmpowerYourStory. And today's hour is also a time for you to tell us what topics that you'd also like the media to cover. And let's go ahead and get started. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And as we said, this year's theme and the hashtag was Empower Your Story. There were several Native radio stations that attended this year's conference. And while I'm at it, I better give the special shout out to the KMHA crew who's listening in Newtown, North Dakota. Folks, they made me promise to do that one. Also, I guess a big ups to all the stations that connect you to our program each week. And at the conference, we also wanted to help empower some of these radio voices and their stories. Yaqui Nation's Hector Yutzi, KPYT Radio Station General Manager, told us of some of his own story and why he's committed to this work.
I feel a buzz. I feel I feel excitement about just Native communities everywhere. With everything that's happening in Washington right now, you know, all the different things that are going on, legislation, and it seems to me like Native America is finally being heard. But I think for a long time, people were just like, oh, well, those are the way things are, and that's the way it is. But now, with people such as yourself, people getting educated, going to school and saying, no, that's not how it should be. That's not the way it is. And I think there's an empowerment now. And I love to empower people. And I love to do this. And I think radio is a really good medium. We have people come in, volunteers that are very, very shy, don't want to talk, you know. And we're like, hey, that's okay, you know. And, oh, I messed up. No, you didn't. No, that's fine. I make that mistake all the time. You make them feel at ease. Before you know it, they don't want to get off the air. And so I think radio is such a great avenue to empower people, you know, for the self-esteem and for the betterment all the way around. That's why I like my job. I'm so passionate about it.
And thanks again to Hector Yutzi for chatting with us. And now I'd like to go ahead and bring in our guest. Joining us from Phoenix, Arizona, is Mary Huditz, and she is the former president of the Native American Journalists Association and the editor of Native People's Magazine. And she is the incoming law enforcement reporter in New Mexico for the Associated Press. And Mary is Crow. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Mary.
Thank you, Tara. And Mary, thank you for being with us. And, you know, we just heard from Hector. I'd also like to hear from you, too, about, you know, more things that we can say about why it's important to empower your story.
Well, I mean, I was just listening to his clip and thinking that I agree so much with him on so many of the different points. I think one of our greatest uphill battles we have right now is, as Native people, is that we are invisible to so many people in the country. And I think there's been evidence this week. We just saw this headline, and I didn't get to look into it too deeply myself, about a reenactment or a 5K race or something like that in Kentucky, I believe, where the whole kind of catch to the event is that for the race is that you'll get chased by people who are reenacting and dressed up as Native Americans. And so when you see stuff like that, you realize probably how much people do not see Natives as human beings still in this country, because we're only 2%, or they think of us as figures from the past. And so media, I think, is probably our greatest vehicle to get our voices out there and to be known and to be present. And from that, I think as people start to see us as the citizens that we are in this country, then we'll start to see the conversation change a little and the narrative, I think, become a little bit more beneficial to our communities.
All right. Thanks, Mary. And you know, this year's conference, there were a lot of folks who came together, and just want to give you a moment, too. There were some really special names that, you know, you put on the panels and brought Native journalists as well as attendees closer to some of the folks, you know, who have things to say. And so, Mary, I wanted you to just kind of give us a little bit of the recap of some of the keynote speakers and, you know, what the thought was as why Native journalists needed to hear these people. Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, sure. I think so much of this is about building relationships. And so I'll tell you who our keynotes are and then elaborate a little more on that. We did have Sally Jewell join us, Interior Secretary, as well as Dr. Charles Monty Russell, who is the Director of the Bureau of Indian Education and actually a former journalist himself, Kevin Washburn, Head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and then also HUD Secretary Julian Castro. So a lot of Obama administration officials came. I think it was so valuable, at least for me, to see our journalists have some time with these officials who are doing things in Washington that affect daily lives of our relatives back home or in the communities that we serve and cover. So I think that was great to foster some communication there. I think, you know, it's hard to see immediate effects out of those sort of conversations, but I think it's gonna change things in the next year and a half. In addition, we welcomed Amanda Blackhorse, and the timing could not have been better. Just days before the day, actually, of our first conference reception and event, the decision came out that the judge had ruled in her favor in the trademark case against the Washington NFL team name, or Pro Football, Inc. So anyway, that was huge, and to get to hear from her, you know, we're journalists and we love news, and this was a newsmaker who came to join us and talk about her experience, so that was fantastic. In addition, we also opened our conference with Charlie LaDuff. He is a really well-known journalist, a Pulitzer Prize winner, worked at the New York Times for a very long time. And then he went into television. I liked his story because he went back to his hometown of Detroit, which I think a lot of big-time journalists with New York Times, you know, just the idea that that's who he was significant and inspiring for us, because we all care at NAJA very much about where we're from, too. And so we wanted to hear from him and kind of why he took this path. And he's a little bit, I would call him a maverick somewhat in television, because he's engaging his sources in different ways, engaging his viewers to be a little bit more intimate with the stories that he covers. He's a very dynamic personality. So it was definitely like a high energy evening. And I guess one more thing about Charlie and then the past keynotes we've had, such as Wab Kanu, who was a correspondent for Al Jazeera, and he's a Canadian journalist, is that just this idea that if we could start to put and promote these TV journalists a little bit more before our membership, maybe we can start to see some more people go in the direction of television. I am a dedicated print journalist. I like to write. I'm not a TV person, but I think it just goes back to that whole idea and that narrative that, you know, people don't see us. They don't see us on TV, but if they did, and if they saw that, you know, we had these authoritative voices and points of view, and just that we were able to, you know, speak towards us others, I think that we would start to see a little bit more respect for our issues, or at least some more intellectual discussion about the many issues facing Native people.
Yeah, you know, Mary, I know a lot of folks agree with you, too. And just thinking about, you know, when we do see Native, you know, folks who are, you know, writing these stories or even on TV, you know, it really creates a presence. And hearing what you just said reminded me of when I saw Nota Bige being one of the commentators on the sports, one of the sports channels. And, you know, it stopped me in my tracks. But I think his him growing his hair out, too, also really caught me. But you know, there is importance of seeing Native folks in the media. And if you are a media maker and you want to tell us why you got into the media, was it because you didn't hear the Native voice or see Native people delivering the news? You can share with us today. Our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And Mary, you mentioned that U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell was among some of the speakers at the conference. She was actually a part of the panel titled Year of the Youth. And yesterday in our discussion, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about focusing in on the youth and what they need to succeed. And this panel that she was on also, you know, talked a little bit about that and the focus of young Native people. I'd like to share some of that now. Here's Jewel talking about what the Department of the Interior is doing in the last months of the administration that it has left in office to address the needs in Indian country.
And it's really doing everything that we can to say, as we close the chapter on this administration a year and a half from now, we will leave a momentum and a pathway forward where no matter who's in the White House, they cannot ignore these issues any longer. So that is our focus.
And also another session at the Native Media Conference focused on energy in Native America. And many stories that both Native and mainstream media cover have to do with energy development, including when energy development and culture collides. A representative from the National Congress of American Indians and a veteran Bloomberg media reporter were two of three panelists. Christopher Dischinney, the director of the Department of Energy's Office of Indian Energy, was also on the panel. And here he is sharing a little bit about the hurdles tribes can face in the energy development arena.
The tragedy is when you deal with Indian energy development, you're dealing with levels of bureaucracy, requirements that hinder development of tribal infrastructure, economies, and then the projects themselves. We're looking at law, we're looking at policy, we're looking at regulations that tribes have to respect and comply with when it comes to energy development. With the Department of Energy and the creation of the Energy Office in 2005, that was an attempt to look at providing a place where an agency like DOE could provide a one-stop shop clearinghouse, a source for technical service, looking at providing technical assistance, all these types of things. So the real challenge, if you look at it, and it's consistent Indian countrywide, is providing support to tribal leaders' development with respect to their economies. So infrastructure and the whole series of related issues to that.
And again, that was Chris Dischinney. And anything that you hear on today's program, if you also want to comment along with us, you can call in. The phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. 2848. We are recapping some of the things that happen at the Native Media Conference, the annual Native American Journalists Association Conference. And if you also went and you want to share your thoughts on what you took away, you can call us too. Phone lines are open. 1-800-99-NATIVE is the number. And a golden question also of today is what more Native stories need to be covered? Again, our phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. Mary, let's go ahead and also expand the hour to bring some room for Jason Begay. He is joining us today from Missoula, Montana, and he is the new Native American Journalists Association president and an assistant professor at the University of Montana School of Journalism, and he is Navajo. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Jason.
Thank you, Tara. Thanks for the invite.
And Jason, congratulations on your new title and picking up. I know Mary left you a great legacy. And anything you just want to start us off with about, you know, looking forward and making more opportunities for Native journalists?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think Mary did such a wonderful job in laying the groundwork and making Nadja a more service-minded for our members. And I really would, that's something I want to keep going as thinking more like, what can we do to give value to our members who pay to be, you know, a part of Nadja, and then who pay to come to the conference. And so what can we do to make that more valuable and worthwhile for them? So I think that's a conversation that we're going to continue having throughout the rest of the year.
All right, great. And Jason, I know, you know, you also had a chance to, you know, see some of the sessions and connect with some folks and take away some great things to bring back to your students. And so I want to get your take on this next clip that we're about to play. A lot of times Nadja serves as a place where people can get closer to stories that are affecting Alaska Native and American Indians. And one issue that many people who cover the news in Native America is federal recognition. We talked with freelance journalist Deb Krall, which is currently, she comes from a tribe which is currently not recognized. Here's what she had to say about the federal recognition process and problems with the criteria.
Well, I share the same concern that the late Vine Deloria did. He wrote one time, after doing a thorough examination of the process, that if the tribes of today were to be subject to that process, two-thirds of them could not meet the criteria. So my stance has always been that why are we being subjected to criteria that two-thirds of the current recognized tribes couldn't meet? Obviously, there's a disconnect someplace, and there's a really big disparity. And you look at the Pamunkey tribe, which just recently became recognized. It took them $2 million to run through this process, a tribe that had its own reservation, that had treaties in place with several other governments, 408 years to finally get the current federal government to actually acknowledge that they were an indigenous tribe. There's something really seriously wrong with the process.
And again, that was Deb Krall, Native freelance journalist from the Haklam Erlone Salinan tribe. And are you also hearing and seeing, maybe even reading about stories tied to the current state of federal recognition and its process and what tribes have to go through to be able to fit the government's definition of being a tribe? And would you like to see more coverage on this issue? You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And also, what other issues connected to Native identity need to get some more time and space on the news? Again, 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Jason, anything you'd like to add about, you know, covering federal recognition?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, here in Montana, we have a tribe that is seeking federal recognition that currently does have state recognition, the Little Shell Band of Chippewa. And in a class I teach where we cover issues that affect Montana's tribes, we're always trying to find a way to bring that question out as to exactly what's the benefit beyond bureaucracy of being labeled a tribe by the federal government. And the answer is always so complex. I mean, every year we try to do something. Every year, the answer is so different. I mean, it's not just like services from federal programs, but it's more like a sense of community and a sense of, like, you know, like where is home if we don't have a reservation, right? I mean, so this question fascinates me, and it's something that I'd really like to see covered, especially here in Montana, you know, personally.
All right. Thanks, Jason. And Mary, you know, what about the complexity of this topic? Any advice to reporters who are covering this issue?
I think just diligence, complete and total diligence, and to be able to see this issue from all the way around. I think, to be honest, a lot of mainstream reporters are covering this one, so a lot of our information is likely coming from on it. And so, you know, I just want to see more empathy, I suppose, in the news business. Like, put your think about the position that, say, Deb Kroll is in, and that'll help you kind of stir up some questions that will really, you know, be of public service. You know, one interesting thing, this isn't by no means a critique, it's just interesting, is that when the Pamunkey were recognized this month, actually, just before our conference in Washington, in the same day or in the same documents, the Duwamish tribe's petition for recognition was denied. So these were, I don't know, they're just two really great stories. And I think in the media's huge rush to focus on the tribe of Pocahontas, the Pamunkey's recognition, they forgot the story about the recognition efforts of Chief Seattle's tribe, the Duwamish. It's just interesting. I think that just speaks to the fact that there are so many stories in Indian country, and we need more journalists to tell them.
All right. And Mary, you know, if folks do want to connect with Nadja, where do they find you?
At www.nadja.com is a great start. NAJournalist is the NAJournalist is the handle for Twitter. And then we have this awesome, you know, we have a Facebook page, but then we also have this just dynamic Facebook group where there's constant conversation every day. So if you're savvy with social media, find the Facebook group for Native American Journalists Association. Those are some great starts. We have speakers. Our members are speaking all over the country almost all the time. Maybe just a little quiet in the last couple of weeks because we just finished our national conference. But there are so many ways to find us, so follow us.
Sure. Well, for us, we came back and, you know, we're booming with all kinds of, you know, thoughts and ideas. And, you know, you've heard some of it in some of the shows that we've done in the past couple of weeks. You know, we also brought you different interviews that we had of voices, including Amanda Blackhorse when we were talking about the Washington football team. And, you know, we're going to continue as the year goes on. We're going to go ahead and pause for a moment, but our phone lines will remain open. If you'd like to share your thoughts today, please do by calling in. Our number is 1-800-996-2848. It's also 1-800-99-NATIVE, and we would definitely like to hear from you. On our next program, we'll take a look at the history and current view on giving birth in Native America. We'll also find out why some Native women are turning to midwives to help bring their babies into this world. Do you feel the views on birth differ from one generation to the next? Join us for this discussion on the next Native America Calling.
I'm Nathan. My job gave me a lot. It gave me an income to support my family. It gave me purpose and pride. But the secondhand smoke there triggered my severe asthma attacks, infections, and lung damage. And I never smoked. It was so bad that my doctor told me I shouldn't work there anymore. I had to quit my job. But the damage was done. Now I'm so sick, I can't do much of anything I used to love to do. I don't referee youth basketball anymore. I don't run or lift weights. It's too much for my body to take. Instead, I'm taking breathing treatments or oxygen. I guess you could say my job gave me a lot. So let me give you a tip. Don't let people tell you that working around secondhand smoke is safe.
Smoking affects more than just your health. If you or someone you know wants free help to quit smoking, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and thank you for joining us today. We're glad that you're tuned in. And if you have a suggestion for a show topic or just want to let us know about programs that we're bringing to you, you can send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter, which is another great way to connect with us. And we're talking about the Native American Journalists Association, or NAJA, and the Native Public Media's conference today. And for several decades, this conference has provided a chance for Native American journalists and other media professionals to catch up, connect, and definitely sharpen their journalistic skills. And today, we're sharing some of it with you through our Native airwaves. And if there's something you'd like to talk about when it comes to Native journalism or Native issues in the news, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And as you've been hearing, Native voices matter in the media, and sometimes the lack of them causes people to get into the media. On-air announcer Ryan Craig from the Yakima Nation and KYNR Radio told us about his passion for radio.
My own personal reasons for getting into radio was because I wanted to have a voice as a Yakima Nation tribal member, because I didn't grow up listening to radio where there were other Yakima tribal members speaking the way that I spoke and talking about the things I love to talk about. So when I was, I think, 17 is when the Yakima Nation first got a radio station. And so that worked out perfect for me, because the first summer of our radio station's existence, I was able to do a summer internship as a high school student. And then because of that summer internship, I fell in love with it, and it made me just want to continue to improve. So here I am now, 33, and still improving in radio and still learning more skills as far as doing the best kind of interview, questions to ask, just how to reach the people.
And thanks again to Ryan Craig for sharing his thoughts with us. Phone lines are open. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-99-NATIVE. And on the line with us today from Missoula, Montana, is Jason Begay, and he is the new Native American Journalists Association president. He's also an assistant professor at the University of Montana School of Journalism, and he comes to us from the Navajo Nation. Also with us today, we have Mary Huditz, and she is the editor of Native Peoples Magazine, and she just wrapped up her term as NAJA president as well. And she comes to us from the Crow Nation. It's our pleasure to welcome both of them back. And Mary, I wanted to get your thoughts. You know, if you were to guess on what kind of percentage of Native media makers and journalists, getting into the business, how many of them would you say are getting into it because the Native voice was lacking?
Oh, gosh. I mean, that would be hard for me to answer completely without real stats, but I would say that's why I got into it. And I'm hearing from the other clips from the journalists who attended our conference that is their reason. And so I think that's a huge motivation. I think it's one of the challenges of NAJA to find those students. Journalism is who feel the same way. Journalism is a tough field, but it's a very rewarding one. It's a very fun one very often. And so I think sometimes my attitude is that I don't want to do recruitment for Native journalist students necessarily and to talk people into going into the industry, but to instead try to find those ones who want to do it, who really have it in their blood to want to do to tell stories and to learn what it takes to be a really good journalist. So that's and I think they're out there. I think there's a large number out there. And so that's what Naja's there for, is to facilitate those careers. Because one of the great things at the conference, I thought, one of the great speeches came on our awards night from Denny McAuliffe, who is a Washington Post editor right now, about to become a professor at University of North Carolina. And he won our Medill Milestone Award, which is one of our most major awards. And he said, really, the reason we honored him was because he helped so many of us get our first jobs or get our foot in the door. And Jason and I are two of those journalists. But, you know, he said this thing that was, it's just like the most simplest and some might even say cliche thing, but it was that, you know, we just wanted a chance, which is true. And so I think that's the beauty of Naja, is there's this cycle where you come in as a student and then you move forward in your career at your company, but you stay part of Naja and you help the next generation. And so we want to find those students who also just want a chance as well.
All right. Thanks, Mary. We also talked with Russell Contreras, who is of Mayan descent and is a reporter with the Associated Press and the president of Unity Journalists for Diversity. And we asked him about the line between activism and journalism.
I think all journalists should keep in mind that they have a goal to tell a story and to be as accurate as possible. And in that process, you're always looking to see who is suffering in our current environment. It is just natural for that. So although we're not activists in a traditional sense, we are looking for the story that's not being told. In that sense, I think some maybe interpret that as activism, but it's really just doing our job. We're not just fact finders. We're not just seed catalog host. We go out there and find the story and tell the story that it's not being done. And at what I do as a journalist, and what I've told folks at Unity to do, is that we have an obligation to go find communities that are underserved, where they're not being reported, their stories are not being covered, and tackle that head on.
And do you think that journalists are finding communities that are underserved and reporting on them? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And Jason, what do you tell your students about that fine line between activism and journalism?
Well, you know, I mean, in my time as a professor, which has been the past 5 years, I find that younger people are really like, the young people who especially are into journalism have really high ideals for themselves and for the industry, and they really want to make a difference. They really want to. I mean, they're firing every single gun they have, right, to make sure that they're heard and that causes are heard. So it's a matter of like pretty much what Russell said in that as journalists we don't really like try to instill change on our own, but what we do is try to shine spotlights in crevices and on questions that most people wouldn't think to answer because they don't have the same background that we do. So kind of, I guess if you could picture like a mirror, and we're basically holding the mirror to the backside of an issue that people wouldn't see, and so they see how much more complex any given story is, and that depends on how well we look at something and analyze it and ask the questions carefully in order to get that full 360 degrees around the story, whereas I think a lot of news now, because of the speed and because of internet, we kind of overlook that part. We kind of just report what's on the surface and don't get very deep. But I mean, it's not that hard, is what I tell my students, to just do a quick roundabout around the issue, like a lap, so at least you get a glimpse of what's on the other side, and in that way we can incite some kind of change or incite some kind of idea into our readers by asking the kind of questions that are there but just kind of aren't seen, obviously.
All right, thanks, Jason. Let's hear some more. We caught up with Dr. Cynthia Coleman at the conference, and she's a professor of communications at Portland State University, and she is Osage. She spoke on a panel about why culture matters in science and health reporting. in Native America. And the discussion touched on how reporters can skew a story by not adding the Native voice. Dr. Coleman used the example of how the Ancient One or Kennewick Man controversy was covered in the media. And Dr. Coleman has been following the media coverage of this individual since his discovery in 1996. Here's what she told us after the session had wrapped up about early media coverage on this issue.
When this began to be covered, the tribes were seen as being a force that was going to prevent the scientists from doing their work. So I found it as reporting that the Indians, even though they were allowed to have a voice, shouldn't have a voice. And I think many of the scientists were frightened, and there's public statements about them being frightened that the Indians would take the skeleton back and it would no longer be available to science. It would be gone forever from science. So that's how the news media tended to report on that.
And Dr. Coleman was on our program on July 16th to talk about the Ancient One. And you can listen to the full discussion on our archives at NativeAmericaCalling.com. And we are talking journalism today. And do you agree with the voice you just heard that news stories can be skewed if the Native voice is missing? And is there a news story that would have hit the public differently if the media outlet added a Native person's perspective? And also, how do you feel when you see coverage of Native communities or issues in the mainstream media? Is it accurate? Call us. The number is 1-800-996-2848 and tell us what you do have on your mind. Jason, you know, the debate over the Ancient One or Kennewick Man brings up a lot of emotions in Native America. Any thoughts on how the media has covered this issue in the past?
Well, you know, I mean, I think overall, Natives just want to have that voice. I mean, there's always this fear of if you don't talk to us, then you know, where's the story going to go? I mean, it's part of our history, it's part of our culture, and it would only make sense that we should get at least some kind of say in it. And I think news media overall kind of. When it comes to science, and this is a big STEM thing, I think, and I think we're going to talk about that soon, is that you know, it's not really what's considered a traditional Native American topic, and so you know the experts are most likely going to be like the traditional scientists and the traditional archaeologists who don't normally tend to be Native Americans. So I think by broadening their well of sources, that's kind of all that Native communities are asking them to do.
All right. Thanks, Jason. Also, veteran journalist Ray Suarez, who's the host of Al Jazeera America's daily program Inside Story, was on a panel. He spoke about indigenous populations from Central, South America, and the Caribbean. And here he is breaking down how some indigenous people identify in the U.S.
There's a kind of underplaying of indigenous roots among Latinos in the United States that's very much and very interestingly contrasted to the very present memory of indigenous life, pre-Columbian indigenous life, among people in Mexico who carry with them every day symbols and signs of long indigenous heritage in the land that's in many ways been subsumed by a Spanish-speaking Western Hemisphere culture, but it's very consciously held by the people there today. I would argue less so in Durango, Colorado, and San Francisco, and Spanish Harlem in New York. There is a rediscovery, I think it's fair to say, a reappreciation of the indigenous heritage of Caribbean people. That's a little bit more complicated because a lot of that has to be reconstructed post facto, because by 50 years after Columbus's arrival, for instance, on the island of Puerto Rico, there wasn't a single living, full-blooded Native person left on the island. Everybody was either the product of intermarriage between arrivals, new arrivals, and people who were already present, or had died in the years of encomienda, the enforced slavery of indigenous people by Spanish explorers and agriculturalists. And so piecing together an intact Taino culture is a little difficult after the fact, but there are people who are preserving scraps of the language, learning it, trying to teach it to others. A very, very great interest in preserving the art and what survives in the hard record of artifacts that date from before the encuentro.
And this is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, and we are taking a look back at the Native American Journalists Association National Conference. We're sharing some of the words that we brought back to you, as well as taking a look at, you know, journalism in general. And we also want to hear what folks have to say about, you know, the news coverage that goes on in Native America and about Native America. You can also send us a tweet, too. Our Twitter handle is at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Becky Brown, Vice President of Global Marketing and Communications at Intel, was also on the scene at NAJA this year. Becky is a member of the Chickasaw Nation, and we asked her about the importance of having Native Americans following educational paths that lead to science, technology, engineering, and the math field. And here's her take on why it's important.
Technology is... it is in everybody's lives today. There's going to be a time where anything that has an on and off button, there's technology that's inside of that. Whether it's your refrigerator, it's a driverless car, you may be getting your pizza delivered to you at some days through a drone. I mean, there's technology is going to be in pretty much every part of our lives. Having that technology built without a diverse point of view, without a Native American point of view that not any other, you know, the neither kind of people have, that would be a real disservice, I think, to the Native Americans. They have a different way of life, a different perspective on the way that technology is going to contribute to their communities. And having people that don't have that exposure create the products that they're going to use later isn't really the kind of products that I think we want to develop, that we want to really, you know, that bring to market. So it's critical from just a portfolio of products that represent all communities and all diversities, that we have those opinions.
And again, that was Becky Brown from Intel, and she is a member of the Chickasaw Nation. Jason, there you go. There's the STEM talk. And before you tell me a little bit more why it's important that we understand those stories, tell everybody what STEM is.
STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, I believe, which is a very hot area of study, especially for programs that are looking for minority people and even more so Native American students.
And, you know, what do you think when we do hear stories like this where, you know, the media or a journalist sees, you know what, a number of Natives is lacking, there's my story. What do you think when you read stories like that, Jason?
When are we stories about STEM not including Native Americans? Is that what you're asking?
Or just a journalist looks at the numbers and said, wait a minute, nobody's talking about the Natives. Nobody's talking about how low the number of Natives is. I mean, how does that make you feel as a journalist to know, hey, they figured out the story, you know, when it was missing?
Yeah, so I think, and then bring it back to the STEM question, I think, I mean, what happens in this story and in others is that it's really easy to overlook like the Native American numbers because it's so small, right? I mean, like if you look at a newsroom or like a news desk that focuses on just STEM, and I'm not sure if that exists, but if that did, right? The number of Native Americans in that field is so small, it would be easy to overlook that. And in addition to that, we kind of see technology as this like equalizer, where we see it as like no matter who you are, where you're from, it can put you on equal footing with the rest of the world if you have like the right kind of iPad and the Wi-Fi signal, right? But that's not necessarily the case if you're looking at places like, you know, like where my family's from, which is Chinle, Arizona, which is like right in the middle of the Navajo Nation, and you know it's like a 5-hour drive to the nearest airport, you know. And so there are things to consider that I think Ms. Brown brought up that make a lot of sense, and that we don't really we're too enamored with how magical technology is, and you know, calling it an equalizer, which is not entirely accurate. And I think news media would do well to, it's almost unrealistic, but they would do well to invest in sending more people out to these areas that don't get that kind of a signal or that kind of infrastructure, to see exactly how it's going to take more than just, you know, building technology. It's like also building inroads to, you know, specific families and specific communities.
All right. Thanks, Jason. And Mary, we also heard, a clip from the Indigenous panel. Anything you want to share about why Nadja decided to offer this panel to folks?
Sure. It actually goes right into the questions of the STEM a little bit, at least when we talk about data. Nadja's conferences are very news-centric. We could try to talk about some of the big things that are being talked about in Indian Country, and then the things that maybe we think are deserving a little bit more discussion and perspective so that our journalists are more equipped to go out and cover them. So we were interested in these census statistics that showed a large new number of people who were identifying as Native, and a lot of what contributed to that was that I think many more Latino citizens and immigrants were identifying as Indigenous or Native American as well. You know, Ray spoke so eloquently to this kind of resurgence and of claiming Indigenous identity. So we wanted to talk about that. In addition to Ray on that panel, we also had a researcher, a really talented one, Mark Hugo Lopez from the Pew Research Foundation. So he added some perspective as well. That's why we had that. And I think understanding data and even how identity kind of what we can take away and understand about how citizens are identifying themselves is a major story that only enriches people's journalistic coverage. That was my primary reason. I think a little bit more to this whole point on data, I think that's as much as journalists try to set that aside as something that we don't, that doesn't really apply to us. I mean, if you look at the internet these days and what is really getting traction, it's stories with data, like that involves looks at maps, like how do different people in different parts of the country think, and I think that stuff is so popular because you get to see yourself in that map. Like I get to see where do I fit into this whole big spectrum of the country. But a lot of times as Natives, we don't get to see ourselves in there because we are not counted. And so we did have a lot of, and that's difficult. That goes back to that whole thing I've been harping on about us being invisible or that we're not heard or seen. And so at the conference, we actually did start to go the way of STEM just a little. I don't know that our data sessions could quite qualify or quite be, you know, described as STEM, but we had several to help journalists prepare for elections. And I just really hope Nadja members start to embrace those things that we are presenting to them. Annie Casey Foundation presented some really enriching content on data as it regards to children and a lot of the disparities that they're facing. And in addition to that, last one is that we introduced coding to our conference agenda. So we had sessions that were very popular. That was exciting to see on HTML and general web coding.
All right. I want to go to a quick comment. We got a caller. Let's bring in Dave, who's in Cortez, Colorado. He's connecting to us today on KSJD. And Dave, I need you to make it quick. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello?
Hello, you're on air.
Hi. My name is Dave. I'm a Tlingit Indian from Southeast Alaska originally, although I live here in Cortez, Colorado now. I have a bachelor's degree in journalism. I'm currently a freelancer, but at one time I was an Alaska correspondent for Indian Country Today. I think that the central problem in Native news media is the same that exists in mainstream journalism, and that is that Native journalists, like mainstream journalists, are disinclined to criticize the institutions that benefit them. They want to maintain that status quo because they profit from it. Tribal governments are universally corrupt, nepotistic, scandal-ridden. In Alaska, where I'm from, the Native corporations have the same problems, yet Native journalists won't criticize them because their friends and relatives work in these governments, and they fund their education and salaries, so they won't cover the corruption, favoritism, and unjustified spending.
And Dave, you know, ethics, you know, I'm glad, you know, you're bringing up, you know, where are the ethics in this? And Jason, that is a beautiful place to have us leave the hour on. You know, real quick, anything on ethics? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and there's no doubt that we're getting better at the scenario that the caller is describing, and that's exactly what Nadja is trying to do is to support more First Amendment rights for all kinds of publications on Indian countries, not just newspapers anymore, but websites and maybe even blogs in the future, right? And so ethics plays a key role in that. How are we going to be able to sway or to inform people appropriately if what we're saying can't be trusted, if what we're saying is coming through a filter of bias, right? And so ethics plays a key role in maintaining public trust with us. If we're trying to give information about the government, then we're better trusted if we are ethical and unbiased.
Thank you, Jason Begay. Also, thank you to Mary Huditz for both joining us. And we have links to Nadja on our website. And we're going to be back again on Monday with a show about birth and natives turning to midwives to welcome their children into this world. If you have something to say on that one, too, send us an email, comments@nativeamericacalling.com, or you can leave comments directly on our website. And you can always send us a tweet at 1-800-99-NATIVE. Monica Brain is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Stephen Emmons is our engineer. Kaveh Movahed screens your calls. And Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm your host, Tara Gatewood. We'll be back on Monday.
The Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma features Choctaw-made merchandise online at ChoctawStore.com. You can own a piece of Choctaw culture delivered to your door, whether it's the works of Choctaw artists, unique apparel, accessories for your home or office, music, videos, and books, including the Choctaw language books. You can find it at ChoctawStore.com. Labor Day delivery available for orders placed on ChoctawStore.com by August 30th. ChoctawStore.com is proud to support Native Voice One.
This program supported by the Peace Corps, the government agency sending thousands of volunteers to live and work alongside people in more than 60 countries worldwide. The Peace Corps will allow you to share your unique cultural heritage and promote world peace and friendship. We have rewarding work opportunities around the world in education, health, agriculture, environment, and business. It will change your life and the lives of others. More information available at peacecorps.gov. That's peacecorps.gov.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.